No niin, hyvää iltapäivää. Jatkamme täällä salissa ohjelmaa ja aloitamme teemalla yksilöllinen oppiminen, oppimisen omistajuus ja arviointikulttuurin muutos. Siinä onkin haastetta kerrakseen näissä teemoissa ja kutsun tänne puhujaksi Janne Cederbergin. Ja mitenkä sinä sanoit, entinen lukio-opettaja, nykyinen opetusalan yrittäjä. Menikö suurin piirtein oikein? Tervetuloa.
Virrat päälle täältä. Kuuluuko nyt taakse? Käsi ylös, jos kuuluu. Takana ei muutama viitannut. Nyt kuuluu paremmin, jes. Säädetään vähän se. Joo, tosiaan tuossa slaidissa on niinku... Lukee Eduhakkerit. Meillä on... Kuka tietää Pekka Peuran nimeltä? Moni tietää. Meillä on Pekan kanssa yksi Oy yhdessä ja sitten mulla on yksi Oy itselleen ja sitten mulla on toiminimi, joka toiminimi mä siirin sille Oylle ja niin edelleen. Mutta niinku... Mutta joka tapauksessa mä olin aikaisemmin lukio-opettajana Itässä Jyväskylän yliopiston kasvattaja olen ja matikka-tietotekniikka-opettajana olin lukiossa ja sitten irtisanoiduin 2011 keväällä lukuvuoden päätteeksi, olin ohjelmistofirmassa välissä töissä nelipäiväisellä työviikolla ja aloittelin omia juttuja ja sitten irtisanoiduin sieltä ja sitten olen tehnyt sitten 2011 loppuvuodesta lähtien yrittäjänä töitä muun muassa opetus.tv-nettisivusta, jos joku tietää. Muutama tietää, niin se on mun ja Turusen Samuelin perustama. Ja sitten Pekan kanssa on tehty paljon yhteistyötä. Mä enemmän teknisellä puolella, Pekka sitten pedagogisella puolella. Ja sitten viimeksi tehnyt semmoista kuin Nettiniilo, joka liittyy ABIT-järjestelmään, eli ylioppilaskokeisiin tarkoitettuun järjestelmän käyttöön kouluarjessa. Mutta se taustasta. Any English speakers? At least one, two. Okay, I'll try to paraphrase every now and then what I said. I told about my background. I used to be a teacher, math, computer science, and now I've been working 5 years as an entrepreneur, combining IT, which I have a kind of like a background also in, and education. Elikkä tämä puheenvuoro on yksilöllinen oppiminen, oppimisen omistajuus, arviointikulttuurin muutos. Eli tämä on se, jos olette Pekka Peuran jutuista mediassa kuullut tai olette Facebookissa ryhmässä, yksilöllinen oppiminen ja oppimisen omistajuus, niin sillä teemalla. Ja lyhykäisyydessään niin aloitetaan tämmöisellä videopätkällä, joka tiivistää sitä, mitä oli tarkoitus sanoa. Mihinkä se nyt häviisi? Onko se tuolla viestiseinän kanssa niin samassa? On. Otetaan se tonne. Tämä oli mun ladattuna valmiiksi, mutta sitten sitä organisoitiin vähän. Tuossahan se näkyy olevan.
Opettajajohtoinen opetus aikataulutetaan siten, että kaikki opetussuunnitelman sisällöt ehditään opettaa kurssin oppituntien aikana. Tällöin yhden aiheen käsittelyyn on etukäteen varattu rajallinen määrä aikaa, ja aika on sama kaikille oppilaille riippumatta hänen lähtötasoistaan ja opiskelutaidoistaan. Opettaja opettaa teorian, ja samalla syntyy käsitys, että kaikki oppivat. Kotiläksyillä oppilaiden tehtävänä on kerätä oppimaansa. Kurssin edetessä osalla oppilaista on vaikeuksia pysyä opetustahdissa mukana, minkä opettaja havaitsee, mutta tunnollisuuden ja velvollisuuden tunne luo painetta pysyä aikataulussa. Lopputuloksena on, että osa oppilaista on oppinut kaiken opetetun, mutta osa oppilaista ei ole oppinut juuri mitään. Suuremmalle osalle oppilaista jää aukkoja tietoihinsa, jotka vaikeuttavat aiheen jatko-oppimista merkittävän paljon. Yksilöllisen oppimisen opetusmallissa oppilaat tutustuvat aiheeseen ryhmissä tai itsenäisesti oppikirjan, opetusvideoiden tai muun oppimismateriaalin avulla. Oppilaiden tutustuessa aiheeseen opettajan on mahdollista antaa henkilökohtaista opetusta ryhmän hitaimmille oppijoille. Samalla lahjakkaimmat oppijat etenevät nopeasti, koska heillä on kyky omaksua itsenäisesti uusia asioita lyhyessä ajassa. Kun ryhmässä joku ei ymmärrä uutta aihetta, lahjakkaimmilla oppijoilla on tilaa auttaa kavereitaan, ja samalla heidän oma osaamisensa vahvistuu. Opettaja voi selvittää yksilöiden virhekäsitykset ja räätälöidä opetuksen huomioiden jokaisen vahvuudet ja heikkoudet. Kurssin edetessä oppilaat eriytyvät taitojensa mukaisesti ja opettajan on mahdollista antaa henkilökohtaista opetusta yksilöllisen avuntarpeen mukaan. Näin myös lahjakkaimpien oppijoiden erityistarpeet huomioidaan. Lopputuloksena saavutetaan merkittävästi paremmat oppimistulokset opettajajohtoiseen opetukseen verrattuna. Hitaimmatkin oppijat omaksuvat opintojen edistymiseen tarvittavat vähimmäistaidot.
Joo, eli semmoinen video, that's the video we created with Pekka in 2012. And so background. Onko kaikilla, onko se jollekin ei ok, jos mä puhun englantia pelkästään? Kukaan ei myönnä, että mä puhun englantia. So maybe you're more familiar with Benjamin Bloom's, the Bloom's taxonomy, which is the staging of how easy people perceive things to learn. Based on what kind of questions you're asking them. Like if you're asking people to just recall some facts, it's easier than trying to apply and create new things based on your current knowledge. But less known is Bloom's research on learning potential. And the idea was that they took as their base situation, the one teacher, 30 students, general standard lecturing type of situation like we have now. I'm talking and you are being silent. He took that as the base situation of like, could we do better than this in terms of what can be reached, how much potential the students have in learning things. Like as a teacher, when you go to classroom, how often do you think of how much could these students learn if they were learning at their optimal ability? Not what they learn, but how much they actually could learn if they had the optimal situation. So then they had one benchmark as one teacher, 30 students, general standard traditional lecturing, and then the other end was one-to-one tutoring, one teacher, one student, and they took the assumption that probably we will reach the best possible results if we have one teacher, one student. That's not practical, but we will have a benchmark to compare the other approaches to. We kind of have a goal to reach to. So, okay, we have lecturing on the left, one-to-one tutoring on the right. And so what this graph is saying, what they realized, this was a longitudinal study, I think over 10 years. And what they realized was that 50% of the students here, the level that they reach in their skills, only 2% reached in the traditional approach. And their assumption was that maybe those 50% in the traditional would have the potential to reach the level that only 2% actually reached. So basically, we could do better, to say shortly. This is a graph of 2011 Finnish ninth grade math exam grade distribution, and it's quite focused on the low end side. The Finnish grading is 4 to 10, 4 being lowest failing grade, and 10 being the best. And yeah, we could do better. So when the teacher is setting the schedule, it's very likely that a lot of the students will not do as well as they could in an optimal situation. Either the teacher's pace will be too fast for the student and they will get frustrated, or the teacher's pace is too slow for the student and they will get frustrated because they already understood the thing a year ago maybe. And they would like to do something more challenging for their skill. So they are not doing as well as they could. a big percentage. The teacher can kind of choose whether the teacher wants to target the top students or the middle students, the middle skill level students, or the ones who are learning slowest, or not necessarily learning slowest, but who have, as a result of their background, maybe things that happened before, they have more gaps in their learning than the others. They're not necessarily slower to learn. But anyway, the teacher can basically choose which part of the group they want to address. And then the rest are kind of not optimally addressed. Benjamin Bloom and his research group, they studied a multitude of different approaches, and you can find in the literature. But the one that they found to be getting closest to the one-to-one tutoring in actual learning results was a thing that they called mastery learning. And the idea is simple. You learn one thing well enough that you feel like you have mastery of it. You feel like you can understand it. You feel like you can explain it to your peers, other students. Basically, as a figure of speech, you learn to ride a two-wheel bike first before you try to learn to ride a unicycle, a one-wheel bike. Not so that you are 80% two-wheel bike rider and then you're told, okay, now take the unicycle. You learn one thing well, then you go forward. Who should decide the speed then? Well, the only person who really knows how they understood the thing is the student themselves. And that results, of course, in a very, heterogeneous mix of students. And some are very far away or studied much, and some are not so far. And how do you address that in a one teacher, 30 students scenery without using more money, because you don't have the money necessarily to use for assistant teachers or things like that? So learn one thing well, and then move forward. A little note about grading or marking, whatever you use in your country for the term. But if you don't see what it says, for a fair selection, everybody has to take the same exam. Please climb that tree. And this is referring to a lot of research, and the punchline is that in English it says grading has a very large effect on what happens in the classroom. Directs the actions or the activities in the classroom very much. A lot of words, but I'll summarize. Basically, the point is that it's hard to objectively, from the outside, be able to stamp a grade on somebody's knowledge, because you only get a very small fraction of, you get to see only a very small fraction of what they're actually doing, and they might have a bad day on some day, and what they produce on a formative exam might not fully represent what they know. Why is my thing not skipping forward? Okay, so Bloom's taxonomy. Now we talk a little bit about that. Often in school life, we focus on the lowest three, which are sort of the easiest ones. And the higher three, we often neglect. Why? Because it's harder to arrange situations where students are involved in the higher three. Maybe it's harder. So for those who don't understand Finnish words, the lowest one is remembering. Then going forward, the orange one is understanding. Then applying, analyzing. What's arvioida? To assessing, making assessments, and then creating. So how do you actually implement this mastery learning in a practical school situation without using more money? This is from a math context. For example, you break this is from high school mathematics schedule point of view, where you have 6 weeks for a course. And then you break that 6-week course content into n amount of parts, say 5 parts, logically coherent parts. And the student practices the first part, and then they do some kind of a self-assessment test, which could be, for example, here, this is something that we created for our group, and this is openly on the internet. So let's say high school mathematics, let's say analytics, analytical geometry, circles right there. Let's see if there's, this one I should have checked beforehand. There's some just written question, but on some of the ones there's interactive illustrations and animations and things like that. I should have checked that one before, but then there's a grading example, and the student first solves the problem and then grades it themselves. Why not a machine grading? Because if you have a machine grading, then the student is actually not forced to use the higher level skills of, let's say, I solved the problem, but I solved it a different way than on this example solution. And now I have to evaluate whether my solution is okay or it's not okay. If I got the same end result, there's a high chance it is okay, but you still have to check through and understand what you did and why your solution is different and whether it's valid, even though it's different. So on purpose, there's no machine grading. And so the student exercises, does exercises, which on math could be just you solve problems from the math book, and they're separated into different chunks, like five chunks, and you practice. And then when you have completed the test or the self-assessment test for part one, then you move forward to part two, and so on. It's just a support for the student doing the self-evaluation. It wouldn't have to be like a self-assessment test necessarily, but it's a tool that the students can then, on a practical level, mark, let's say, in their notebook that, oh, I got such and such a grade, and they kind of like it. It's kind of gamification in a way. So what are you doing here in terms of Bloom's taxonomy? When you're doing the problems, you're using the lower three. When you're evaluating either your own work or your friend's work, then you are using the higher levels on Bloom's taxonomy. Creating is omitted on purpose. In math, creating new mathematical stuff that wasn't created yet is impossible on the high school level. But yeah. In other subjects, it's not necessarily impossible creating. Sorry? Might be possible. I mean, if you're smart enough, then yeah. Or yeah. But I mean, you can maybe surely possible to come up with a way of solving something that the teacher didn't think about. Yes. It's probably not new in all of mathematics research, but it might be new to the teacher. It happened to me once, a student solved a problem in a way that I didn't conceive it could be solved that way, and it was worth 6 points. And I gave them 7 for it. And I also bought them an ice cream. So how about grading? Because earlier there was a reference to the way you grade or whatever you assess has a large impact on what the students will actually do and the actions in the class. So how about we have no exam? Sounds pretty radical. The Finnish curriculum doesn't mandate you to have an exam. In high school, it mandates you, the teacher, to give a grade, but it doesn't say you have to have an exam. Oral exams, suulliset kokeet, are very have a long tradition, but they are kind of slightly forgotten. But back in the Greek days, when they talked in the market square and so on, oral exams were more like the norm and written exams were the exception, as far as I've understood. Might be wrong. But anyway, so The student works during the six-week period in the high school context and solves problems. And then at the end, they have a discussion with the teacher. Oh, I'm out of time, or almost out of time. So basically, that's the breakout. You divide the course into, say, 5 parts or 9 parts or whatever is logical. The students work on those parts, do self-assessment tests, work with each other, asking questions, check the book, search online materials, ask for teacher for help, and so on, like we saw on the first video. And this is, for example, one way of marking it. They have the topics. This is topic one, topic two. They have these numbers are referring to exam or exercise problems in the book, and they solve them, and then they do the self-assessment tests right here. And if they fail the first one, they practice more and do the next one and so on. They only need to do one if they pass it the first time. They could, of course, cheat on it, but they're cheating themselves. And the teacher can, in the discussion at the end of the class, end of the course, the teacher can say, okay, you marked, you got 90% on this self-assessment test. Could you explain what you did? And if the student is totally oblivious and doesn't know how to explain it, then probably they didn't do it themselves. So that's the practical details, practicalities of it, and then there's some stuff that I'm going to just hop over. And a guided self-assessment. These are the tools for grading. Guided self-assessment, and then a discussion with the student. Normally, we have in high school, we have an exam week, and each course has like one prep class, usually organized this way, one prep class and 3 hours for the exam. So instead of doing the exam, the teacher can use that time to have a discussion, one-to-one discussion with the students, a few minutes, 5 minutes per student. So that's pretty much out of time, and thank you very much. Vaikka se on myös Suomessa.
Because at least lots of things were coming to my head, and there was something that you kind of covered, you know, like in terms of the student self-assessment and actually correcting their own tasks. You mentioned, of course, if they cheat, then they're cheating themselves. What kind of ways, I mean, is there some kind of ways that you can instill, for example, within the mathematics tasks, this form of creativity, you know, like how can you encourage creativity and other ways of thinking the problems through?
One thing that is absolutely vital for that is to have time. Mm-hmm. Like you're not pressured, okay, if you're working in a situation where the teacher says, okay, today our topic is X, whatever, then the students are not going to fully dive into the topic because they know that the bell will ring and then next class they will move to another topic. So it's required for the students to be able to use as much time as possible or as much time as they feel like they need on the topic. And that, of course, results in not all students covering the same material during that course. And that one you all might have noticed if you were fast enough, you noticed it here. Right here. Here it says, if you complete the first 4 sections, then you will have a grade between 7 and 8, roughly. If you complete also the 5th section, then you will have a grade roughly around 9 or 10. And a question that somebody might be thinking, but didn't voice it, if the students give grades to themselves, which in a way they do in this case, how many of them would give themselves a 10? The first time, this is based on what Pekka Peura has been trying in his own teaching. The first time he tried this, he was scared to try it, but he thought, okay, this one course, it can't go terribly wrong, so we might as well try it. So he thought, okay, let's see how many will give themselves a 10. And he thought, there's at least 3 students that I would give, like he said, I would give a 10 to. But none of them, no one, not a single person, not a single student gave a 10 to themselves. That was analytical mathematics, analytical geometry, long math course number 4. Nobody gave a 10, even though he thought a few students should have had a 10. But the student said it felt more honest. They knew, like on an exam, you can go to an exam and the lecturer might not ask such a topic that you didn't understand or know. But you kind of like get to bypass that because there wasn't a question on that, about that topic. So the students were, they said they felt it was more honest because they knew they didn't know something well enough to think they deserve a 10. So they said, I don't deserve a 10, I deserve a 9. Which is kind of surprising.
Plus the things are so modest.
Maybe that's also part of it. Maybe
yeah,
that's also part of it. Yeah.
Definitely. And
Maybe. But all the discussion, when a teacher has a discussion with the student, which you can have time for if you don't have the written exam, then in a discussion, it's quite quick to realize, okay, a student says something, and they say a little bit kind of like a little funny or something. And as a teacher, as a professional, you can right away spot, could you explain that a little more in detail? You can very quickly spot if they know what they're talking about or they don't know. That's why when you have a PhD, you have you defend your thesis and it's oral and you can have a question about anything and you have to be able to answer that. It's a lot more, in a way, high pressure than having an exam where you can just prepare and think about, I would write it this way or that way. And, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Should I just leave that like that?
Take a seat. Awesome. Relax.
How many are we?
And there's five of you, so there should be a seat.
Okay.
From Lentava Leto Taulu and also Zeppo. And then we have also Maria.
Hello.
Maria Taifalenmaki from, and I'm so sorry because I do speak Australian, so if the Finnish names sound funny, it's because of that. But from Siti Nomadi,
yeah.
Oru. And then we also have Mikael Uusimäkkilä from Teaching Game. Teaching
them, sorry,
in 5 more minutes. Oh,
good.
And
I changed my hat,
so. Okay. But they're going to be telling more about this in a second. And then, of course, we've got Johannes Edgar that you've just heard from. And now, what we're going to be doing today... is in a second, I'll show you exactly these questions that I gave everyone to think about in terms of their preparation for the panel today. So, first of all, now it's funny, I actually developed these questions in English and then they were translated to the Finnish and now I'll translate them back to English. This is about the idea and the end user's role in the design and the development process. So, user research undertaken during the process. Now they were given freedom to kind of like pick and choose and think about whether these actually apply to their nutshell description of their processes. the second question was, how does learning and teaching, or the teaching practices, for example, teaching and learning styles, how much is that observed in the design of these learning solutions? And then what are the learning solutions' developmental challenges, or the development of these learning solutions' challenges, and the opportunity for information technology industry, now Sarawak.
In
the field of the area.
In the area.
In the area of information technology. Let's start again. Now, I'm going to mix this up a bit because we've just heard from Daphne. So let's start from Paulina. Could you please give us an introduction to your processes in a nutshell?
Yes, so Ilana IT is a little educational technology company, and we are from Helsinki and from Tampere and from Kuopio, Eastern Finland also. Basically, we are providing, our services are consultancy and then teacher training. And I am a teacher trainer, and I teach mobile learning environments and digital learning environments to in the whole area of education in Finland. I mean, from the primary education to university level, and that's our main service at the moment. Then we are also selling some. Mikä on härpäke englanniksi? Robotics and gadgets and things like that. Also, we have some licenses to services, and so that's our main business. And what was the question then?
Introduce.
You gave a good introduction. Thank you. Well, maybe we'll just do this introduction first, and then we'll get down to the questions.
Yeah. That's good.
And so then, Tero.
Yeah. Hi, can you hear me? I guess so. Tero Kulha, company called Lentävä Liitutaulu, but for a reason we call ourselves Seppos, Seppo in Finnish, because that's so complicated, especially in other countries. But Lentävä Liitutaulu, it's a game-based learning company. We have a specialized in game-based learning, and Seppo is our main product at the moment. It's a platform for teachers to create educational games. That's in shortly. I'm a chairman of the board of the company. In practice, I'm as any other startup entrepreneur.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Merja Taipalemäki, and I come from a city nomadi from Tampere, Tammerfors, a little bit south from Jyväskylä. But Jyväskylä has been playing. A great role in developing this school nomadic product of ours, because we have participated in this SysTech project from its beginning, and actually we reflected our ideas to schools via and through the researchers of this university. So we got the feedback from schools that our idea of drawing educational learning paths for pupils and pupils for doing design learning on our platform and on our apps were worth for research and development activities in the future. What we do, we create a map-based service for mobile phones and web sites, and we have different lines of activities, but the school nomadi is one of our main products at the moment. My background is not in education, but I feel that we try to get the feedback from the educational sector via our partners and via schools we are working with. That's why the cooperation, for example, with universities and researchers is so important to us.
Hey, I'm so glad many of you stayed. It would be much less, much more boring if it were, you know, two people in the front row. I work for two companies. I can change my hats on the fly here. Let's start with Hitachi Gaming. So how many of you know Minecraft? There we go, that's pretty good. So with Teacher Gaming, we work with the educational version of Minecraft and other entertainment games. So our business is kind of converting entertainment games into educational products. And like the company name suggests, most of us have a teaching background. I'm an English teacher myself, so we rely a lot on the intuition we have by our training, but obviously a lot of our feedback comes from our teacher community. We are fortunate enough to have around 15,000 schools around the world who use our products, and we have a teacher community about 2,500 teachers who actively provide feedback, so they play a crucial role. And in case someone is up to date with the recent news, we sold Minecraft EDU to Microsoft, so I'm changing over to my other hat. So now that we are a well-funded company and we have a lot of free time in our hands, we founded another one called 5 More Minutes, that produces our own IP. And with 5 More Minutes, we are basically, most of us are from the same team. We are now producing our own first game that's called Nuts and Bolts. And Nuts and Bolts teaches computational thinking to 5 to 10-year-olds. And now that we are actually creating our own game, getting that feedback as early on as you can is, again, vital. So our first development step was looking for partners. So who's dumb enough to let us try this with their kids? Unfortunately, there's the city of Joensuu in Eastern Finland who were, so we now can you know, go and spoil the youth of Eastern Finland with our little games. But yeah, we're a 15-people geek squad from Tampere, so same place. And most of us are 30-something, 20-something people, most of us with teaching background, but also gaming, so a lot of the company culture has to do with gaming, so we play a lot of games together. We have LAN parties, where we also do crazy stuff like last summer we built catapults, so we took two days off and went to the woods to build catapults. They actually work. I have a video if anyone wants to see. But a lot of the processes we have are informal, and they have a lot to do with the playful nature of the products we actually create. So a lot of play goes into the development. But yeah, over to you, I guess.
So, Janne, again, Cederberg, my last name. Min pappa är svenskspråkig, om ni tänkte om den saken. Jag är inte svenskspråkig officiellt. That was Swedish for you English speakers. I have a teacher background, like I mentioned, and then also I've been working with web development, web design type of things as a freelancer, never really full-time, since I was in high school myself. So now, as an entrepreneur, I've been combining the two, the teacher background and the IT background. And so now Pekka Peura was mentioned, and so we've done, him and me and a few others, Lauri Hedesten, Samuli Turunen, and so on. For example, the opetus.tv website, which has, if you know Khan Academy, it's similar. The difference is that Khan Academy has like $15 million US dollars in funding, and we did it with our own money. We have 1,800 videos currently, and they're in Finnish, high school content mostly, some junior high, mostly math, natural sciences, the site is getting like about 4,000, 5,000 visitors a day on like exam weeks, and if you compare that to if it would be English language and it would be a scale of 100, that would mean 500,000, 400,000 visitors a day. So and then besides that, I've been working on a customized wireless network or router for high school exam digitalization. That's what I've been doing actually mostly for the past 1.5 years, which I didn't mention earlier. It's called Netti Niilo. Maybe somebody has heard.
that came up during the day and I wanted to ask you was the idea of computational thinking. How do you see your solutions either supporting this movement towards the computational thinking, or how do you see it as posing a challenge to, or you know, the movement towards teaching computational thinking? How does that challenge, for example, the design of digital solutions? Do you see a synthesis or a challenge?
Well, actually, both. I think that the digital solution should have both ways, giving straightforward tasks for pupils, directly giving some material for teachers. But there should be a part for creativity as well, so the teachers and pupils could do, I don't know if the design learning is the word at the moment, is it trendy or not, but anyway, they could create something of their own. And I just visited the Nuts and Bolts demo stand, and I noticed that it's a great idea because it gives you an opportunity to try yourself. And actually, we do have this phenomenon, we have this feature as well, we do have a possibility for the pupils and teachers to make the gaming features by themselves. So and we are going to improve this further on. But it's just a part of it. The other part is to be a cozy passive learner. So you don't really have to do too much. And the teachers, they might choose from the possibilities.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, it's nice to also have these options to be able to choose the move naturally.
A comment, when I was writing my thesis, my master's thesis, my thesis advisor had on his wall a quote that was relating to mathematics, but I think it relates to the context now. It said, in the university, mathematics students will tend to think that mathematics is deductive in reasoning at its core, until later they realize that actually it's inductive. Like you just try out stuff and see what happens. And I think this is what we should get students into doing more, because to just try and see what happens, having space, having time to be able to experiment and try. And also that relates to, in a way, you have to have boldness, in a way, to come up with some new idea that nobody told you, and an environment where students are not bashed or shunned for new ideas or different ways of looking at things. Maybe some of the ideas don't work, maybe some do, but the fact that the student came up with the idea and wanted to, let's see what happens if we do this and that. And then either it works or it doesn't, but the student learned a lot.
Yeah. Thank you.
And then I think this whole thing is like this big cultural change, because this requires from the teachers the courage to ask questions and let the students ask questions and to create. And when you add those computing skills into this, then it might be sometimes a little bit too much even. Mm-hmm. And then we need people who sort of, take it slow, take it calm, let's see this together. We need sort of mentors in there. And I think for my work is part of like that. And then we have also, I have played this Seppo game, and in there, perhaps you want to tell, but there are these both sides of it, that you can have this material, ready-made material in the game, and then you have the process where the students can pose questions and create their own material and bring it to others. And I think it's great. But sometimes maybe there was a question of challenges. It might be challenged, the huge cultural change and then the computing skills at the same time.
Was it Mikael?
Yeah, so I kind of feel that a lot of this is symptomatic of the paradigm shift from the consumer culture to the creator culture. And it just seems as computational thinking or coding or whatever you want to call it right now just acts as the catalyst to bring it on or to the discussion in many of these tables. And coming from a field of, you know, games, we make games, so the trial and error kind of mindset, having the boldness to fail or having the opportunity to fail in the first place, is kind of built into the medium itself. So a lot of the challenges that we face is that we have a generation of students who probably are used to, at least on a level, some level, they're used to facing these problems, but then we have teachers who aren't. And, you know, it's a natural problem. It's about relinquishing control or, you know, not being in charge or not understanding everything that goes on at every single moment. So as a teacher, I get that. That's a tremendous challenge. So, yeah, if anyone's scared as hell, I kind of get it. I get it. So
we'll probably speak more about the paradigm shift sure. later. But if we take this computing thing in the beginning, have an additional viewpoint to that, and it's been somehow amusing that you don't necessarily need to have computer to teach computing at all.
No.
And I have as an example, I think it's quite funny that most of you have heard and know Linda Liukas, and how she teach computing and algorithm at preschool or 5 or 6 or 7 year olds, and some funny examples that no software, nothing. He has a carbon box, and she puts someone inside who should act as a CPU, central processing unit, and there are input holes and output holes, and the code and algorithm is given in papers inside. So they get the idea how the computer work itself, and the logic without any computer. And this is probably something that could be done. It can be done without a technology at all, or it can be done with many of our tools in general, so it can be used. So it doesn't have to be a software to teach computing or programming at all.
As a short side note to the English speakers, the new primary school curriculum in Finland actually specifies learning the basics of computational thinking or programming. And in the first and second year, it's specifically written so that you don't have to, or you shouldn't, I don't remember which way, but you shouldn't use computers, but you should use just one person giving instructions and the other person carrying out the instructions.
Learning loops and learning
exactly. Learning how to give specific enough and also clear enough instructions so that the other person can execute, and also the other person shouldn't do anything else than what was instructed.
Yeah, and this is actually related to what Oppo was talking about and how they're actually going to be instilling the programming education within careers, like making it tangible and understandable at first. Able to put a face to what's actually happening and then moving more abstract to the actual coding system. It's very interesting. And then on this note, what has been the role of research and how do you see the role of research within your development processes?
In general, it's probably always done too little.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a nice theory that yeah we are doing it and we probably all are doing it, but still, coming from a small company, you can't expect any of us, well we are from small companies, you cannot expect on us to do extensive research. You have to be close to the university. It's a plus. It's very useful. You should collect the existing research. And you definitely should do more work with teachers and end users.
Mm.
we feel guilty not being able to do it enough. We are doing it, but yeah. Not enough.
Ladies first.
Okay.
Okay, thanks. The usability research should be done continuously. So we're trying to get feedback from our users all the time, and it's not so easy all the time. You have to have the processes for that somehow. And with schools, it might be a little bit easier than I think, because teachers are good to give feedback, and pupils are good to give feedback. So if you just are brave enough to ask, you probably get feedback. Then you should need someone to research, the researcher to analyze it, because you just can't hop from one feedback to another and try to please everyone. You you should collect it and analyze it and make the conclusions out of it. But actually, the user feedback is very crucial for products that are in production, on which are on market at the moment already. And I think that there is a matter of cooperation with universities, with schools, with different kind of organizations. So.
Yeah. I guess most of us coming from software development side have the kind of iterative design process built into it. Since the early 1990s, it's been part of the core thing for us. So compared to many other industries, software mm-hmm. industry is probably pretty good at, you know, getting it out early and seeing what sticks. So you were probably at a good place in terms of that. But at the same time, I feel like we're running the risk of confusing that with real research. So getting the fast iterative feedback is one thing, but then having the rigorous testing or the big enough N in your research to make it to validate the data you have, there's a difference. And most of us, at least on the gaming industry side, end up, you know, thinking that your user feedback you get from your family, you know, that's valid. So we're probably, on one level, we're pretty good at getting early feedback and getting the versions out early, so we're not designing ready products. So it lives, the process is a living one. So you get new features all the time. But at the same time, I feel like we should include research side on the development more. But there are a lot of challenges, like funding cycles or, you know, I need this research now, not 18 months from now. So having that kind of, if you have a software as a service kind of model, obviously that works, but yeah, there are challenges, so it's like trying to fit a square peg in a round hole. So I feel like there's a lot of room for having research, and at least from on an edtech side, having the validation for schools is crucial, but it's not a straightforward business in my head.
Yeah, probably we can't tell any teacher or any school that by using any of our products makes your pupils smarter or they learn things better, because the research haven't been done on a long run yet. So it takes time. You can't really prove the pedagogical results yet. So you need volume, you need time, you need very very well structured research before there is an obvious proof for that.
Yeah, so that it would be scientifically
solid.
Solid. That's correct. Right. Yeah. Correct.
Yes. But then on the other hand, when we are providing teacher training, then all our trainings must or should or have to be based on the research on pedagogy, and and we have to all the time follow what is going on also in the research, and we have good relationships with the universities and universities of applied sciences. But that's true that the research is sort of coming a little bit behind if we talk, for example, about mobile learning and what it is. is there mobile learning, or is it just a pedagogical target and then we use mobile devices and blah, blah, blah. But when I read the articles, then they are sort of a little bit behind always. Mm-hmm. And then I can think, okay, we already tested that, and okay, we already knew that. And the research, it has to be there, but it's strange because these digital environments and everything is going on so fast. And
yeah, it's very useful if somebody comes and proves it's something that you already know.
Yes, and Finnish teachers are very tietoisia.
And they conscious.
Conscious about this. And they sometimes they even ask that, do you have proof for this? Mm-hmm. And
But why it is important that schools they follow the digital trends and they use the e-learning products and they use the e-learning possibilities is that the whole society is developing forward and the digital world is it's something the pupils they step into when they go to the working environment. Exactly. And that's why it's important that people learn to understand what is software, what is computing, etc., etc. So it's not just to prove that our products they make the kids smarter, but it's also they train them to their life in the future.
The classical 21st century skills.
That's right.
But everyone is talking about.
Yeah. That was already covered.
I haven't seen research into why books are so beneficial in schools for a while, and we're still using them.
Books are good.
Yeah, I agree, but who the hell does the research? Yeah. You're all doing this trendy business with mobile phones and games. Go and research books we already use.
You know, yeah. there is a gadget with which you can first record a poem, and then when you put the gadget there and here and there, mm-hmm. and then touch the book where the poem is, then it says the poem there. Right. So if you have a student who cannot speak, for example, then if he or she touches the book, the poem comes. That's why I like these digital things.
absolutely. I mean, and then kind of, I guess, getting back to the research and stuff, the ideal relationship between research and development. And could you imagine a way of researchers being in sync with what's happening within the industry and vice versa?
Yeah, having an in-house researcher would be an awesome thing. So if anyone's interested, we can be take us application in no time. Where are you guys? But
heads up.
Yeah. So. Yeah, in an ideal situation, there would be the part of the user testing we do would also, contribute to the mass of research in a more closer way. It's not, I'm not saying it's miles away. We're not in a bad place, but there are obviously challenges to solve, and a lot of them have to do with funding. So I guess a lot of startups in the edtech area, at least, are still smallish enough, so bigger companies do have their research divisions, so given the time when one of the unicorns just happens to be born in Finland at the time, why the hell not? So I wouldn't mind having a research division of my own.
Yeah, I agree in that sense that it's not necessarily that far away, that especially in game industry, if you start a company, it's very likely that you build the many kind of statistics and reporting and metrics inside the software at the beginning. And now, if it booms, if it becomes a big, you come close to the big data things, that you get a huge amount of different customer behavior figures and features out of there, and then you need somebody who analyzes that, data analyst or something. And it is research. Perhaps you need something more scientific to put the theory as part of that, but I can imagine that many startups are doing. Aren't you, by the way?
We are, yeah. We do analytics as well, and we're building an analytics engine if anyone's interested in that big set of data. But many game, bigger game industries like King, who does Candy Crush games, if anyone's played, they have a big whole division dedicated to this. Yeah. And I went to listen to their data analysts talk, and it could have been a recess conference. Yeah. So, like you said, probably the big difference is not including a theory section at the beginning. But you are doing the effective analysis already.
Yeah.
So why not?
What they do little small things in changing something or yep. in marketing or something.
And yeah, A/B testing.
They follow the impact immediately.
Robbio and Supercell also exactly. doing very extensively yeah. the same thing.
Yeah. And how do you know which things to actually measure? Are there standards? Do you just follow peers or competition, yeah. or do you have other?
There's a term, it's KPI. So what's the key performance indices are that you're actually tracking, and that's where you need the data analysts. So you have the business idea, and then you derive your key performance indices from that key idea. So if I'm making a game for schools and I want to have private users play that game, then probably my key performance index would be the conversion rate from school users into private users. Mm-hmm. So recognizing stuff like that derives from your business logic, probably. Mm-hmm. But knowing what to track is really important. So yeah. having that kind of expertise, usually your engineers won't have it, your artists won't have it, your game designers won't. So I see in the future, I see a lot of flow from research into industry.
But then again, that part of kind of research or metrics is easy, but then the missing part can be that how to relate that to the better learning results.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And that's something you don't have KPI for that probably.
Yeah.
Not yet, unfortunately.
It's easy to gather the
data.
Quantified data, but the qualified data
right.
is more important, and it's more difficult, and it takes time.
Yeah.
So and you have to know what kind of things you need to go after.
Yep.
So
then a little bit other angle to this is that we are very interested to find out how gamification impacts the learning results, that's for sure. But then we have an advisor who had a great line once that at the end of the day, it's not necessarily a matter of what you learn in practice, as long as you have a feeling that you have learned something, you get excited, now I learned something, I understood something. And that can make difference. That can bring you to the new orbital track of liking learning, loving learning, and so forth. So, in some sense, it might be even important. It might be very difficult to measure altogether.
Well, because see, I was just thinking about this relationship between qualitative data and, of course, like this sharing of the feeling of actually learning something. I mean, has social media been included? Within actually tracking what people are actually saying about
the game. We are not yet there ourselves. I don't know the others.
Yes, we try to be as active in social media as possible, but it's not so easy to get attention. Mm-hmm. So to get the users to react. So I think the silence is good.
It works.
Yes, it tells you that you haven't done anything so very badly.
Yeah.
But to get the proper feedback there is it would be important, and I think the social media would be very very good. Commercial companies, the companies who have some kind of consumer-based products, they use social media quite a lot. But I think that there is some, different kinds of problems, ethical problems, etc., to use it to use it for education. So I don't know which company would be the forerunner for this.
Question to the audience. Who knows TED.com? TED, T-E-D. Yeah. Doesn't refer to a person. It's a site with videos, those who don't know, conference videos and talks. Who's seen a video entitled Motivation by Daniel Pink? One. I would suggest, please, watch that video, Motivation by Daniel Pink. If you just search on TED.com, you search for motivation, you'll find it. But there's he didn't research it, he's just like publicizing it. But there's three aspects that he talks about: autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Autonomy, you have a large enough box to play in. Mastery, you feel you're good at whatever you're doing. And purpose, you feel like it's relevant in some larger context. And these also play into what I was saying in my earlier presentation. I didn't name them out loud, but when students feel these three three qualities in their day-to-day activity in the classroom, they will be more motivated from the inside, from the willingness of learning new stuff, than from the outside of like teacher telling them you should now learn this. And with these three ingredients, when you get them together, the student or whoever is doing whatever, they will start to feel ownership of what they're doing. And this is kind of like what you were talking about.
Sure. Yeah. And incidentally, all of those three things are also components of flow. As well. So I guess there's a lot of there. That's one of the reasons why games, you know, engage you as well as they do. So I guess, there's a lot of the same thing. So if you can bring that same feeling into a learning process.
Yeah.
And coming back to the earlier discussion about the what you're measuring and stuff, there's a level of, we're talking about learning outcomes usually, and there's a problem with, you know, being obsessed with the learning outcomes, doing the A-B tests. This group used games and this one doesn't. There are so many more things that we need to be measuring. The motivation that when you go home, maybe you read more about dinosaurs or foreign planets or the water pressure in some dam or stuff like that. That's usually stuff that goes unnoticed. And a lot of solutions we do here contribute to stuff like that that doesn't show in the metrics necessarily. Mm-hmm. So having the qualitative and the quantitative data both there, it contributes to the end results greatly.
And then that comes down to also what are the components of motivation? What motivates you to actually want to learn more? Want to kind of like perform better, possibly even, you know, like receiving complete, you know, like perfect support within some kind of a solution is your motivation, just to be able to do that properly.
And doing that motivates you, and you have a vicious cycle of learning.
Absolutely. Paulina, you've got five more minutes left until...
Yes.
Thank you for the promotion.
Yeah.
Five more minutes. Four more minutes, she got.
I didn't get it right away.
I mean, do you have anything to add at this moment before I ask my next question?
No, actually, you can ask that. I can answer that first, then.
Maybe. Okay, beautiful. Because now it comes down to, of course, you know, like, there's... naturally a certain amount of knowledge that goes into, you know, like, I mean, first of all, motivating the game developer and the designer to actually initiate the game, I mean, the game development, the game design, etc. And, you know, as you were talking about flow, etc., you know, knowing the mechanisms or at least somehow understanding either explicitly or tacitly possibly how the user is going to be perceiving the game, you know, is one factor. But can you describe the synergy between what is designer-led and what is user-led? How should this relationship operate within the development of the
solution? Can I answer?
Yeah,
we don't develop games, but
From
the other point of view, before I leave... I think it's very important for the teachers to understand the basics of gaming when they are implementing games in any teaching. So why not start with that?
Yeah.
And I think that when you are introducing game or any platform, you should always have this little explanation of why mm-hmm. and how. Mm-hmm. So they are basics, but sometimes teachers, they can say, okay, we have had games before. Why is this different? And why should I use this digitally? Because some of the games, they are not changing so much the ways that we behave inside the classrooms. They are sort of replacing the old methods, and that's why it's important to explain.
This is actually a very important issue also, is considering the teachers not just as end users, but also as learning experience creators and designers as well. And in order to be able to align, for example, their practices and their thinking with, you know, like the logics of the game and vice versa is actually really important.
And being also the guide of the game for the students.
Yeah. Thank you very much. And now,
one thing that relates to that on a very foundational level is how teachers perceive their role in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And if the teacher perceives their role as the gatekeeper to information, then there's like a clash, possibly. And also, like in a situation that I described in my presentation, if the teacher feels that they are not kind of like losing their control of the classroom situation, in the sense that not everybody is doing the same thing, and the teacher doesn't know cannot control, in the sense that the two students are kind of like moving on their own initiative into new topics partially, then there's a large change that needs to happen for teachers in the mindset. Mm. And that's not, I would say it's not a small change.
Yeah. It's a huge change.
Yeah, it's a huge change. And I guess there's a lot of, when we're talking about games or other digital solutions in classrooms, we tend to go into the preaching mode and talk about revolutions in classrooms. And if you think about that in the context of your own work, how would you feel if someone comes to your workplace and tells you that you've been doing it wrong, by the way, I'm going to come here with this fancy gadget, I'm going to fix it, there's a revolution going on. Yeah. So rather than thinking about games or other digital solutions as the revolution itself, it can act as the catalyst for that revolution. So we are, hopefully none of us go to the schools telling you that we are going to revolutionize what you do. We are giving you tools that hopefully would guide you in that direction. And then we can talk about the paradigm shifts and the sage on the stage shift to the guide by the side stuff. But please, if anyone's thinking about going into this business, don't go preaching revolution. That's my one rule.
Did you have comments?
Go ahead.
Yeah. First of all, you don't have any easy questions there.
I'm sorry.
No problem. One thing related somehow to your question is that one thing what is important to keep in mind that games and gamification are not the same thing. Okay. We tend to take these two things together, and you can gamify your teaching and learning without a game. That you bring some game-based elements into that. And simply giving points or something like that. Let me see. That's something else in mind, but I'll leave it to the next comment.
Okay.
I forgot it, sorry.
No, that's okay.
I had one comment, but now I forgot what it was. I'm sorry.
I think it's time to go home.
Is it Friday after? So if everyone's still away, does anyone have any questions?
Of the role of by which they can conduct a research on what we call in academia action. So assume I'm going to implement a new learning solution in my teaching. So I need to have three parts: the technology part, and the content part, and the delivery part, by which I assume I have two. By which you can have like performance indicators, whether you are doing fine or you need to manipulate that or you need to fix that. I think we need to go further in this world.
Good point. Thank you. For instance, we would have a very good case for research cooperation. That is that we are genuinely interested that if someone does a research that they compare two similar classes which are comparable, and they really see and check, and the N has to be big enough that how gamification, for instance, impacts the learning effects. According to that pyramid you had,
Bloom's taxonomy. What was it? Bloom's taxonomy.
Yeah, like which things make you remember things better, which makes it understand. And I think it's exactly to your point that it's not something that research is coming inside and doing something scientific. It's very important for us, and I think that you can make a proper scientific research from that.
I agree, it's a good point, and that's something we have seen a lot with what we saw with Minecraft, a lot of case studies coming from teachers who have been using it themselves, and we've been helping with that. For us, the big hurdle was, you know, taking the next step from that one. There was a gap between doing that, so we have tons of case studies about, you know, a smaller number of kids doing this with A-B testing and stuff like that. There wasn't... my question to you guys as researchers is, how can we help, you know, you guys come in and help us take the next step from action research case studies to the broader data sets?
Yeah. Yes. Any researchers here who would like to answer that?
I want to add just one point.
Yeah.
And still you have to pay the bill.
And you know, I guess we are used to that already since we put our stuff out and early, so we are used to critical feedback, so like I hope many of us wouldn't have a problem with that.
And the dynamics, and also to give more insight into, you know, innovation space, which is really, really good, because I think from the Australian perspective, we have this notion that, okay, companies buy research to get scientific backing behind their products.
Yeah.
But here in Finland, I think that the atmosphere is so that, you know, at least it's been happening for the last decade, that, you know, like, there is this kind of open environment. Like results that can be published and results that can't be. But then at the same time, from a scientific perspective as well as from a developmental perspective, the unity is really, really strong. in my experience. And of course, then again, the researchers are also tied to budget. You know, what kind of project funding is available? How much time do we have to perform analysis? And what are our job responsibilities as well on top of the research? But fund that.
Can they hear?
Oh, will you? No.
And somebody said also that it doesn't work. So you might want to take the one next to the water pitcher.
Hello.
Yes,
that's
okay. Oh, it works.
Okay. Thanks, Rebecca, so much. Hey. I really agree or everything you said, because it's really topical that we do research in real life context, that we really test in schools with kids and with children. It's not enough that we have some expert evaluation, that some specialists are testing in the kind of laboratory settings. So I really agree that we need more joint R&D projects together with companies. And researchers are really willing to do this research if we can get funded. So it's thank you.
Okay, because I'm just next to the microphone, so I guess it's my go. I didn't know. But okay, my one question: what for the panelists? Like, if you have to say it in one sentence, what would be the most useful thing you would need from the research perspective? Like, what do you like now? Like at this moment, your specific need that you would like to have support from researchers.
I'd like to know that whether applying gamification improves learning results according to Bloom's taxonomy, for instance. If it does, and this is from Michael, this is a hint for you. If it does, it's dynamite for our marketing. If it does not, and I'm very curious to hear the objective result. If it doesn't, we have to figure out something else, like we have to figure out the concept differently. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't accept a study which is not objective. Like, there's no point in that. No point to buy a research.
Not at all.
One sentence. The hypothesis that is giving a critical analysis of our doing, not just product, but the thing we are doing in general in a larger context.
And pedagogical context.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Having someone with a more rigorous mindset and more time than we do in our two-week development cycle is awesome. But if I can steal one more sentence. Besides having the rigorous mindset and having the time to do stuff for us, having actionable research points, so making the research reports actionable, so having suggestions, stuff like that. So oftentimes the results tend to be, you know, they declarative stuff. They indicate something, but no one kind of, you know, connects the dots for you. You can say that, no, well, it didn't work, then please venture a guess why it didn't, that kind of stuff.
I'll say one thing from Opetus TV point of view, from the video point of view. It would be interesting to find out on a nationwide scale, like, what kind of use, because the website is, you can use it anonymously. So we have a lot of user feedback. So actually contacting the people who have given feedback and talking to them and finding out, and maybe also doing like a large questionnaire, like a survey thing, that would be awesome. Because a lot of students, they give feedback like they understood, they got a lot of help from just watching the videos on the site. So.
And this debate continues on tomorrow, when we've got some fantastic discussions. displays and panels, but until then, have a lovely evening and afternoon. And thank you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.